Hello and welcome. My name is Kyle, and this is How You Level Up, a podcast that decodes language to help you become your best self. Today, I speak with Hussein Halleck. He is an author, a father, serial entrepreneur, and has spent the last 25 years building over 20 startups. He's worked and supported thousands of founders at the Launch Academy, one of North America's top tech incubators. His insights on entrepreneurship and innovation have reached millions through Forbes, BBC, and Business Insider. Hussein's ventures reflect his diverse passions, from launching Momentable, which connects emerging artists with art collectors, to performing as one of Syria's top vocalists, to founding Next Decentrum, a leading company in emerging technology education. As an author, Hussein's new book, The Dark Art of Life Mastery, helps readers navigate life with resilience and authenticity. I thought it was great, so of course I wanted to get into the mind behind the great book. Our conversation today is personal, it's fun, and it's a fantastic look under the hood for why, above all, Hussein believes in living fully, questioning deeply, and the transformative power of human connection. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Thank you for joining us today, Hussein. It's wonderful to have someone with your experience join the podcast. You have been in a lot of different places, have done a lot of wonderful things. I think I want to start at the beginning, if you would be so kind. You describe yourself as a Syrian-born Canadian troublemaker, clueless father, hopeless romantic. These are all really, really great descriptors. But bring us back to Damascus in the 1980s, if you would. What was it like watching your grandfather's wealth disappear and your family go from well-off to poor?
Oh, interesting. I don't know how you got that, but I do talk about it, but like, where did you find it? That's awesome. Thanks for the introduction. And I rarely have anybody actually read my bio that I put in the book, which is awesome because it is actually a very good descriptor of who I am for people who know me as a person. In 1980s, what I do remember is kind of growing up, my grandfather had, my father had left his hometown to live in Damascus. And my grandfather had a lot of land and was very rich. He actually used to put money in bags. But my father decided kind of to have his own life in Damascus. And what ended up happening in the 80s, I think there was sanctions on Syria. So all I remember is me standing in line. I do remember a little bit of earlier days when we had, you know, good, my parents used to have parties. It was like a middle-class family that was always having fun, let's say. Then came the sanctions. And I remember vividly waiting in line to pick up tea, rice, and sugar through coupons. Basically, each family would have its own shares. There was no supermarkets. There's no place where you can get, let's say, any other food. That was how you got food. Right. There were, of course, places where there is kind of smuggling stuff into Syria that you could buy if you had the money. And at that time as well, my grandfather used to be very generous. He doesn't look at money at all, like in the sense that he doesn't. For him, it didn't matter that he being rich. So he actually, whoever asked for money, and he had six daughters, and they all, I mean, the smallest family was four, and then like six, eight, 12. Oh my. And there's a lot of them. And they would come in and ask him for money for, let's say, building a pharmacy or doing something. He would give it because these are his family. He would give it away. And he didn't keep track. He didn't do that. He just gave the money away. And not because he didn't have management, it's because what he valued most was the ground or the earth where he planted. And he always thought that that's his purpose, is to kind of bring up the land and plant it and make it kind of produce. He's always thought that that is your purpose and that's your target, and money is just a byproduct that he's meant to give away to kind of for the people that matter in his life. Unfortunately, a lot of people abuse that, and and my father didn't want to. Didn't want anything to do with that. So that meant that we, and because the conditions in Syria progressively kind of deteriorated, by the early by the late 80s, I would say, we were kind of not making ends meet had to borrow money to survive.
Were there choices that you saw your grandfather or your own parents make during that transition? And of course, all of the troubles, you know, you do have to make new choices, but was there something specific that you attempt to replicate in your life today, not being in such a location, currently living in Canada?
I think the one thing I carried with me is that regardless of whatever our financial conditions were, my parents maintained their commitment to who they are as people. So, for example, my father used to work in the government, and there were a lot of pressures. He was once, I remember the story, he was once handling the distribution of homes. And there was a general who came and said, I want this home. And that home was dedicated for a family of orphans. And my father put his foot down and he refused to do that. And he's just an employee. I mean, in a dictatorship like Syria, he would be removed very easily. And he had to leave his position, but he maintained until the end to give that house to the family that earned it. I remember that. Now, when I was young, I was looking at my parents, and all I understood at the time, I didn't understand those decisions, because mm-hmm. I point to my family and say, why aren't we like the other families who have money? And my father would respond, we have principles. And I was like, I didn't understand what that meant, honestly. I just understood that I couldn't get what I wanted to get. The other thing that is a vivid memory I remember is that our house is always filled with people. And I was wondering, like, we don't have enough food to kind of to feed ourselves. How come we're always hosting people? My mom used to work at a school for special needs. And her earlier students will come visit her because she was so dedicated to her job as a teacher. And I remember, you know, those were my victims. I would actually kind of show them my drawings. I would play music when I started playing guitar after. So those were my victims. They were my audience that were kind of hostage at home for me and my whatever kind of things I come up with. But I always remember that our home was always open for whoever's visiting from our hometown or somebody passing or a neighbor that they had in a previous building. They would come along and visit. And this kind of stayed with me. And I never really understood it at the time, because at the time I was always worried about what I could get. Mm-hmm. But as growing up, I really valued as like how committed they were to who they are as people. And even though the troubles that they kind of went through, it ended up being great, because it ended up raising me to be someone who values principles at a time when, you know, people are willing to let go of their principles for anything that makes them money. And I think that is what I value the most. And looking back, I wouldn't change any of those decisions. And I would say that they, within the circumstances that they had, they did their very best.
During your transition from Damascus to Canada, what assumptions did you bring with you that you had to completely abandon?
That's a very powerful question. Well, I passed through Dubai first. I stayed there for 11 years and then moved to Canada. But I think some of those assumptions are the things that I grew up valuing in Damascus are, you know, everybody values. Mm-hmm. And I brought those assumptions, and of course, every culture is different. People are different. And I had to be more open in Canada and more kind of be open to learning again, how people see certain things and why do they see those certain things in a certain ways. In Damascus, I was isolated from many different things, like, you know, like LGBTQ people, for example. We do have them, but we don't recognize them. So being allowing people to be who they are and being around them, being comfortable around them, was a little bit challenging at the very beginning. Not because of any kind of preconceived notion, it's because I wasn't ever around people who are comfortable, let's say, in their sexuality or how they express themselves in the world. So that was, for example, one of the things that I had to get used to. The other thing is, I'm very used to saying my opinion and talking politics. And in Syria, you are used to people being very different. Like, we'll have one family, especially in my hometown called Salamiya. We'll have one family, and one person will be a capitalist, you know, and someone who believes in like the Western world, and the other will be a Marxist, and the other will be doesn't care. Some will be supporting of the system, some will not, and they will be the same family, and they will have dinner after, and before dinner they were like you know fighting and arguing and everything, but they will maintain to be a family. It was a little bit jarring for me to see people kind of in their political opinions to be kind of team players, and they don't, you know, they don't kind of identify and separate themselves from each other. So that was a little bit also different for me, because like, what's the problem in sharing your opinions? And in business here, you don't talk about neither, what is it? I think the three, don't talk money, politics and sex. I think these are the things you don't talk in business, right? Anger anybody. It's like, okay, I'm used to being around people, you know, we always disagree because we come from different backgrounds.
Yes. Yeah. The cultural shift from being very open and direct, perhaps, right? So a lot of the language, I'm not extremely familiar with it, but I know a little bit enough to say the language too is a direct language. You know, when you're speaking to family and to friends in the Middle East, it is nothing like the language that dances around, and you know, there are so many different ways to say the same thing, whereas that's not always the same outside of English. Like, it's more direct, it's to the point. I have an idea, here it is, what do you think of it?
Funny enough, in business, actually, we have something called saving face. So when you're in business and in front of other people, in the Arabic culture, you actually save face, in the sense that you don't put somebody, you know, you don't criticize somebody directly. Mm-hmm. Whereas in America or the Western world, I love that, which is like, you know, you state your opinion and all of that when it comes to business. But the opposite is true when you're in family, because in your family, you sit down with anyone, they will dig into your life, like who's that person with, why you're with them, and they will actually, I mean, even any member of the family, even like your neighbor, will come in and say, I don't think this is the best for you. there is that community approach. In some areas it's helpful because people are coming from a kind of a good place where they want the best for you in their own vision. Mm-hmm. I miss that kind of collective, you know, interaction, if you wish. And there's another way where, you know, you don't want sometimes people to interfere in some of the things that you care about. But they will back off if you tell them, like, you know, but that genuine interest from every member of the family is something that is interesting and different. And I had to see those differences and kind of work with them. And I love them. I love those differences. I don't believe anyone has any kind of hold on what's good or what's, you know, beneficial. I think every kind of thing, and that's what I love by moving around between those cities and living with different cultures. I continue to learn and absorb what benefits and what I can build on and what I can take to help others as well.
I want to dive into that just a little bit in terms of, you know, your neighbor or your family wanting to have the best for you, and they sort of layer those ideas that they have on top of you as you're growing up or even as an adult. They want the best for you in terms of what they think of as the best. You describe something within the book, which is that you're standing at the helm of a ship with a millennia of beliefs, histories, and life experiences shaping every thought behind you. How do you go about making choices when there's so much influence that is pressed upon us by these external factors?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I acknowledge that I am those influences, whether I realize them or not. Before, I used to think the more I read, the more I kind of, you know, like became, let's say, aware. I was like, oh, I have the best, you know, beliefs, and I'm saved. I'm cleansed from my past or the cultural influences. I think it was me tricking myself. And I think one of the key things that I came as I matured more, I was like, no, I have many influences. Some I am aware of, many I'm not. And I can't kind of shed my skin, even like how I look, how I think. There's a lot of things I don't have control over. So the first thing is I acknowledge that there are influences that I don't know about. And then I ask what matters most for this choice. So when I make choices, am I making those choices by default? Is there something driving me? And I use this term called the compass, which are things that I choose to believe. And I continue to kind of investigate and choose and use those as my compass to driving the choices and the decisions that I make. And because I chose those, they work as a far better mechanism to help me stay on track rather than just making choices based on gut feeling, which I used to do. And I do sometimes, or trusting myself kind of endlessly, which is important as well to trust yourself, but I trust the things that I choose and I continue to tinker at and work on. Kind of the difference between, you know, composing a song or writing something, or just, you know, saying things right off the dome, if you wish. Both are valid, and you may actually create beautiful music that way. You may come up with beautiful poetry. But if you want to come up with something that you kind of really understand and learn from, you put it and you start tinkering with it, just like you would edit an article or you kind of work on a song.
We're gonna come back to music. I want to dive a little bit into the metaphors that we're using here. And specifically, one of the metaphors that you're using is a compass, right? Or standing at the helm of your ship. How and why do metaphors work for you? How is it that you're leaning into them or perhaps dismissing them if they're no longer applying to your life?
Nice. I think metaphors are very powerful because they create an image. While we love, I would say, language and languages of communication, but images are very powerful as well because they they kind of capture our imagination, which is why I used images and written word in my book. So metaphors for me articulate complex thoughts in a simple thing. Like you say, you know, you're the captain of your ship. It can mean so many different things in once. Instead of saying you control what you make in your destiny and you control your decisions, you're the captain of your ship. Therefore, you actually have control. You can guide it where it goes. You can build on it and you can tell a story based on it. So I love metaphors because they allow me to communicate far easier with others. They allowed me to communicate complex thoughts and complex ideas. And, I think it's something that I continue to use in conversations, and they grow as I talk to more people. So a lot of these metaphors have grown from different conversations that I've been having for 20 years or 30 years with people that I've been trying to advise, mainly my siblings. every time there is something, I would jump in. And I would in their words, they would call it a lecture. Oh, it's another Hussein lecture. And I was like, you can do this and you can do that. So that's where it came from. They were my first victims. And then throughout the years, continuing that conversation, it's like, oh, and when I like a metaphor, I repeat it, expand on it, and then become part of my kind of linguistic, let's say, instruments.
Yes.
Kind of like riffs on a guitar, if you wish.
Right, right. So the metaphor of that you use in your book at one point is the imaginary throne of control. And you talk about stepping down from that throne and stepping up to the helm. And I'd like to know about a specific moment, if you could share, where you realized you weren't the king of your circumstances and you were just navigating the perilous storm of life.
Oh my God, you're going straight to the jugular. great one, actually. That is probably one of the strongest metaphors, because all of my life I've been working to become, you know, the king of my domain, and everything that I did, it means a lot to me. Particularly, a lot of everything in the book actually is very much inspired by my life and my experiences, but it's not about me, because I felt that these are the ones that kind of I saw them repeating in others, and that's why I write about them. And in particular, this one is because everything that I thought and went after in my life, like playing guitar or writing poetry or anything. I wanted to be the master of it. I wanted to be the best. And I wanted, and I had this idea that once I reach that point, I can command anything. Like all I have to do is work so hard to get to that point, let's say have a lot of money or have the position. And then from there, it's easy. From there, all I have to do is kind of point and direct and everything. And that's kind of the king mentality, which is, you know, you're sitting on the throne and everything from there, you just order people to run with it. The same thing with the company. I was like, okay, once I'm manager and I'm leading my own company, I can tell people to do things and things will be easy from that. And the reality begs to disagree. Time after time after time, I will reach that point. I was one of the top, you know, leading men in bands in Syria. I played guitar and I became extremely good with guitar. I mastered, let's say, my use of language and writing. I had my own company several times, but things didn't materially change. I was like, okay, I'm still dealing with this, with the same shit I'm dealing with. Like, what's going on? Why can't I just point and do? And that's what I had to change the metaphor of, like, you know, becoming king, because it's worthless. What actually all that you can hope for is to realize that you are the captain of your own ship and that the sea will throw everything at you. And all you can do at any given moment is deal with what's happening in the moment. That's all you have. And once you realize that, you realize that nobody's better. Like, yeah, some people have more resources and all of that. But reality, if you really want to live, not to, you want to show other people that you're living, that's different. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can show, other people can show you, look at my house, look at everything. And that may be something. But if you really want to live and you want to, what joy it matters to you, you really have to be at the helm making choices, because that is where joy lives. And unless you're doing that, I don't care how much you have, and I've seen people who have everything, you have nothing. Right. So that's kind of the metaphor that I played with, and the movement between a king and a captain.
So being one of the top musicians in Syria, how is it that you made the decision to move? And it seems like we've almost had a back and forth in your life of music, art, engineering, entrepreneurship, you know, an incredible coach and mentor. You're switching back and forth between the worlds of creativity and uncertainty with the world of predictability, right? Business worlds, go be an engineer, then become a manager, then start your own business when you save up enough. And now we're stepping into this world where you're leading people and guiding them through the perils of their own life. How are you transitioning during each of these stages of your life? What are the choices that you're making?
When I was in, like, growing up, I would say, there was no, I talk about this quite a bit, which is there's no future in the sense that in Syria, you really couldn't become anything. Like, you get the engineering degree, but you can't become, I don't know, one of these engineers. Like, I couldn't become Steve Jobs, for example, even though he's Syrian. But you can't become Steve Jobs in Syria. You can't become an astronaut in Syria. You can't, I don't know how even you become a fireman in Syria, honestly. All of the things that you, I mean, even a football player, you would have generals who would actually force their cousins, for example. He's my cousin. Put him, you know, to play attack position. Doesn't have to play football at all, doesn't have, but he just have to be there. So everything was kind of in not planned based on your effort or accolades in life or how you work. So that nothing you could realize with let's say a path that you can chart. So that nothing was possible. So for me, that meant everything's possible. Why don't I do anything I can get my hands on? So I used to speak very good English, and I still do, thankfully. But at the time, because I loved the language and I listened to a lot of music and I picked up the language. I used to actually hate Arabic translation in movies, and I listened to the movie and actually correct the Arabic translation while I'm reading it. So I would when the opportunity came, we were sitting with the friends. I was like, "Hey, let's build a band. Let's create a band." And all of them sucked in English. So I was like, okay, I'll sing because I speak good English. My voice was not that good. So I went and trained my ass off just to make it. So what I would do is I will step in and time after time, I'll say, I'll do this, I'll do this, I'll do this. And even though I don't know, I'll go and learn it. I'll use it as a reason to go learn it and do better at it and come back and do my very best. And this kind of attitude came from, well, you know, what do I have to lose? Anyway, I'm not gonna, it's like, even if I suck in music, it's not like I can become, you know, like there is a scout from Sony. It was like, let's say 90s. And that's a, let's say a scout from Sony or one of these, you know, recording companies that will see me and will, you know, put us as the next band. There was no such story. It's like, the best you can do is come on the stage. I was like, okay, I'll do it because I want to be on stage. I want to experience what that like. So I did everything that was possible to me, or any opportunity, I'll say yes to it. I became kind of the yes man. And that, I experienced a lot of joy in it because I realized, like, oh, I love all of those things. And even the stuff that I sucked at or the stuff that I didn't like after, I was like, I'm glad that I did it. So that kind of became the mode of how I went about doing life. It's like when somebody says, will you open a creative consultancy? It's like, sure, let's do it. And after my first job in Dubai, where I get to help one of the Disney of the Middle East build like 10 companies, I created a creative consultancy and I worked on the first animation out of Dubai. I worked with the first jewelry designer out of Abu Dhabi. Like things that I've never thought. If you tell me, you know, would you work on this? I said, I don't have no idea how I got there. But because I said yes to a few things, and just let it went and rolled with it, and that kind of became how I kind of went through those. Coming back to your question, so that's what gave me the diversity. But then after I realized I love these things, it became to me more of like, why would I choose to pursue something? Like right now, why would I go and learn AI? Mm-hmm. And is it because AI is a trend for everyone, or is there something I want in it? And that's kind of change everything. It's like, what do I want? What is my compass in it? And I said, if something, my compass is usually three questions. Number one, do I like the people? Because life is too short to work with people you don't like. The second is, is there an alignment with the vision that we want for the world? Doesn't have to be the same vision. And the third, can I leave a legacy? And everything that I touch right now is empowered by these three decisions. And they wouldn't have come if I hadn't actually worked in many different fields and tried to kind of reconcile why I'm doing this.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
It does, yeah. And I think those decisions to move towards what you find interesting or working with people you like to work with, those are really powerful questions to ask yourself, because we don't always ask ourselves that. Very often you end up in a job where, you know, you don't love your manager that you interviewed with, but you want the job because you need money and so forth. It's also a little bit similar to one of the series of questions that I like to ask when joining a company, which is, is there a vision for the world that this company has? Do I believe in the vision? And do the people in the company believe that they can reach that vision, make it actual? And if all of those three things are, you know, towards the positive rather than the negative, then it's good. And I might want to join that company. Yeah, very, very interesting that you have a similar sort of question to ask in that respect. This kind of brings me to the part in your book where you're talking about perception and reality. You talk about a gap between what really is and what you want or imagine or perceive the world to be. Can you give me an example from somewhere in your entrepreneurial journey that is you minding that gap and then it changed the outcome?
Yeah. In fact, in entrepreneurship world, it's one of the key things that comes up to that. As entrepreneurs, I always say to the founders that I work with, we are very, very good at bullshit. We can bullshit everyone else. We can bullshit ourselves even. And the idea is that you have, you know, you look at something and you see something that others don't see. And you can't actually separate, we were talking about the cultures and the things that play in the background. You can't separate that whether what you're seeing is because of the actual opportunity mm-hmm. or your tendency to see things that don't exist. Either way, that doesn't matter. as long as you recognize the gap between what you're actually seeing and what is. So what I try to do with my writing is that almost everything's okay, unless it's something really atrocious and outside the boundaries of human beings. So it's okay to see something that nobody else has seen. It's okay to have a vision that is so elaborate, you know, so unrealistic. That's perfectly fine, as long as you're anchored in reality. So it's okay to think, you know, you're heading on your ship as a captain towards the treasure island, and the treasures are so, you know, out of this world that it's remarkable. That's your dream. Who am I to take it away from you and say, that's not reality? However, where you need to be on the ship, because that's where navigation happens. If you are in your dream so much that you don't live in reality, what ends up happening is you end up losing. You end up kind of making the missteps, and you never can realize a dream, whether it's real or not. So I say to people, what's the mechanism? Great that you have a vision, but what's the mechanism to see what's reality and to deal with reality? So the idea is that you need to ask yourself certain questions, and questions are far more powerful than the answers, because answers are made up. Questions actually open yourself up to actually look for the answer. So there is this thing that we teach in kind of the startup world, which is, you know, love the problem, not the solution. One of my coaches used to say, you know, get married to the question, not the answer.
Yeah.
Which is like, commit to the question. What that does is that as long as you're in the question and you're in search for an answer, even if some of the answers are made up, if you're still open, you will find answers that are not made up. You will kind of be in. So if your question is, what will the startup do? You can start, the answer might be your vision. It's like, the world's going to be better. I'm going to change the world. Well, that's okay. What else? What will it help these guys? What does it do right now? What does it do tomorrow? And if you stay asking questions, you'll stumble on answers that kind of keep you grounded and help you move forward. And that is what we want. We just want that you take kind of actionable steps and real steps towards whatever vision you're after. And today we have AI, we have blockchain, we have technologies that 20 years ago, we would think those are like magic, would never in a way. 30 years ago, 40 years ago, for me and you to be across, you know, countries or vast amount of land and just have a conversation in the moment and with this kind of quality is insane. Like, that's magic. That's teleporting for us right now.
Yeah.
Closest thing to get to that.
It absolutely is.
So anything is possible, and you should pursue grand visions as long as you're anchored in reality. And that is the gap I like to kind of let people think about and be open to.
Yeah, the marriage of questions, I like that. It's not the frame of reference that you used in the book. It was, fuck answers, questions are the shit. which, of course, is a very bold statement. And a lot of the book is very punchy and strong and direct. And it really cuts through all of the unnecessary foam and gets us to like the broth of what's delicious. That we need in life, that the sustenance and the nutrients.
You know why I did it that way? Do you want me to?
Yeah, please, please.
So one of my favorite things is to have conversations with people, and that's how my coaching. So I don't coach people like as a coach, but I coach everyone that I'm in their lives, whether they like it or not. So I'll be walking with a friend. So the book is actually like a conversation with a friend, like how you'd have it with a friend. And this is exactly how I speak. I will, if I'm angry at someone or they saying something ridiculous, I'll tell them like, what is this shit? Like, you're ridiculous. And I'll be very direct with them, because it's the best thing I know to be honest with them and not kind of let them. Because if somebody's about to fall, you can't tell them, hey, by the way, I don't want to hurt your feelings, whatever, but you're going to kind of like step. And they're like, they fell already. No, it's like, hey, stop, you idiot. Like, that's how you sometimes have to save people. So that's one. And the other thing is that the reason why there's art is because the best conversations I've ever had were while walking in a gallery or a museum. We'll be walking, we'll stand in front of something, and that thing will kind of guide the conversation or be impacted by the conversation we're having. So I wanted the book to be like a walk in a gallery where you're having a conversation with someone who really cares about you and someone who cares about you enough to not kind of engage in meaningless words. Like they will tell you as it is and leave it for you to make whatever a points you want. Mm-hmm. That's what the book, I think, leaves. And that's why actually physically in the spaces, pages that you can write your own thoughts. And also it doesn't enforce something. It tells you something and leaves you to it. It doesn't come back to it and pushes you and hammer it on. It just kind of keeps reminding you and take you around that journey of a conversation.
Yeah. You had mentioned just not too long ago, you mentioned how the questions that we ask are really the more important piece, right? And so what's a question that you are currently asking that you're still asking yourself, you haven't made a decision on, which ultimately you call that a decision too. What's a question that you're still asking yourself and you haven't moved towards at all? You're still sort of living in that fantasy. You haven't made it reality yet.
What's next? That is the question. I wake up and it's haunted me every moment. It's like, what's next? What's next? I feel definitely privileged and lucky that I feel like joy right now. I'm surrounded by the people I love. I'm writing extensively. I am meeting great people on a podcast. I finished my book. It's not that I don't want anything in life. I'm just asking. I want everything from life. I want like 10 other books. I want to continue writing. I want more of this. But what's next is, like, what's the next big thing? Do I need to do the big thing? And just wondering, and like, do I need something more? Is life over? Is life just beginning? What does it mean? Like, this is what's next is the question haunting me when I wake up until I sleep. And it's the question that I'm also avoiding to answer, in the sense, like, do I have to be next? Like, I'm enjoying it here. Do I have to do more? So, And I understand that it's a privilege because a lot of people don't have, and I was, me, like, sometimes I have the privilege of some days next and some days take over. Like I say, you know, it takes over your life and you have to remember. Mm-hmm. But 10 years ago, I wasn't here. I was like, I know what's next is like make more money or pay rent or something like that. So I'm lucky that I'm not there yet at that place. I'm in a different mm-hmm. place. And my most haunting question is what's next?
You saying what's next, it's almost, there's an inherent quality to it, which is like, I want more, but you don't need more. And you know that from growing up and watching your family have so much and then have nothing or near nothing. And you have what is called the someday doctrine. And it's the idea where you'll be happy someday when you have X. Mm-hmm. And how is it that you're battling with that someday question, or excuse me, the what's next question, knowing that everything that you could ever want, you already have through your successful career and your, you know, various works.
Yeah, someday was like, it's still like, again, one of the things that I felt that the people who wrote the books that I read, like, okay, they got life figured out. And I felt like after writing this book, one of the key things is like, do I have life figured out? Do I have the right to put the book out there? And I don't have life figured out and still deal with, like, you know, someday when I have, you know, more money, or, you know, I'll be in a different position, or, you know, I will be living in a different city, I'll be able to do X, Y, Z. And yeah, that still plays in the background. But I would say it's to a very lesser degree. Mm. I'm very much, thankfully, anchored in today and what I want today. And I'm the way I keep reminding myself is to be in touch with the things I value most. And I think that we underestimate that. We underestimate because we make up things. I'll give you an example. Like I thought that once I, you know, achieve a certain level of financial security, I'll be then able to enjoy, you know, a good time with my wife or with my kids. I'll have more time to spend with them. And when I moved to Vancouver, I still had that idea. And then I, at the time, I was looking for a job and I couldn't find a job. It's like I applied for 200 jobs. So I had a lot of time, you know, waiting for a job. It wasn't fun because it was like, you know, money's running out, and there was a lot of stress. But I had some of the best days of my life because I had way more time to play with my kids. And we spent so much time playing at the parks. And because Vancouver's weather is different than Dubai, it's very hard to work to play at the parks. And, you know, once summer hits, and which summer hits, Dubai is like a long, hot summer and a short, less hot summer. So summer, the hot summer hits in like in March. So here I am, March in Vancouver. The sun is rising, beautiful weather, right on the sea, and in a park where the kids are so happy. And I'm just enjoying playing with them. I was like, I don't want anything that this moment, and I can have this moment without, you know, having millions at the banks or something like that. So why am I am actually making up those conditions. It was a moment of realization. And I knew I was doing it, but like I wasn't aware that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So I was like, I'm making up these conditions. I'm saying to myself that I can't enjoy a moment like this before XYZ happens. You know, what if I drop XYZ? Not that I want them, I still want them, but as conditions to get that. And when I started doing that, and I started doing more often, I started realizing that a lot of the things I enjoy in life, I could have them right now and then. Like, so why am I waiting? So I started doing that, and I started at the same time pursuing the things that I want to pursue, you know, like financial security and being in a position and a job. And I said, why can't I have all? And that kind of question opened me up. It's like, yeah, I want to have all, and started doing that. So, and thankfully, even though it's very bad, I hated COVID, but COVID kind of gave us this remote life where now I can work from home, be around my kids, you know, eat whenever I want. I'm a foodie. I love eating, you know, have my time, work in my PJs. Like, you know, you can have so many things. And I'm sure I'm luckier than many people out there who don't have those privileges. But everyone wants different things in their lives. And these are the things I want that I now can enjoy. And I don't have to put conditions for. So that's how I became aware of that. And that's how I kind of dealt with it. And while some days still exist, I kind of reduced its impact on my life. Mm-hmm.
I'm a expecting father. What are some of the things that you are trying to instill in your children as lessons? And how is it that you're going about instilling them? Knowing that, of course, they're going to rebel against everything you say at a certain point. What are you doing to achieve that?
I was very lucky that my parents were exceptional parents. They, of course, like any parent, they made a lot of mistakes, but they also did a lot of things right, and I'm very thankful for them. So one of the key things that I'm instilling in my kids is to treat them like peers. I remember my son was, I think, 5, and we would always treat them like, not like kids who don't have any agency. We treat them like, And of course, not like adults because they don't have yet the development, but we'll treat them like persons. We'll ask them, we'll take their opinions. We won't make decisions without involving them in the process. And by the time they were 12, I mean, that's when they were young, it's all love. So it's giving them love, all of that. Of course, I regret a few things, you know, and started to think of them as, people I can learn from. And we can engage in a different kind of conversation. It became so much more fun. At 5-year-old, even in my book, I think you saw, I wrote about my son being one of my top mentors because I learned a lot from him when I started letting go of the idea of I'm the father and he's the son. Of course, in certain areas, when we're crossing the street, when we're outside, I'm the father, I'm responsible for him. But when we're together, it's like, I'm curious. Instead of, you know, telling him stuff, it's like, what do you think? How do we deal with that? And then as he got to 12-year-old, I realized that I don't have control over what he's learning, and I don't want to. School is doing a great job here in Canada. But I wanted to give him more, empower him with more information. I didn't want him to grow up to be an adult without having certain things. So I started actually rewarding him for reading books and books that I would choose. So I chose books like The Power of Habit, which is based on research, Lean Startup, Angel, which is about angel investing. And I started giving and said, listen, for every book you read, I'll give you $5. And he started reading books. And a 12-year-old, he would show up to Launch Academy, which is an incubator, and show up to talks. Let's say Jason Calacanis, who's one of the top investors from Silicon Valley, who wrote Angel, I was interviewing him. We were like doing an event community. He was in Vancouver, and he walks in and he finds Zane, my son, 12-year-old, holding his book. He's like, "What are you doing here?" So I think the biggest thing that tells about that is not like I'm a great father or anything, even though I think I am to a certain extent. My kids probably will disagree to a certain extent. No, they love us. We really have a great relationship. But I think one of the key things is that I was interested in building a relationship, and I was caring enough to see what's the best way. And I didn't do the same, let's say, with my daughter, because she was a different person. So my son was voracious, and he was interested in the work they're doing. So I kind of opened up for him to do that. My daughter was different. My daughter writes, and so I read her writing, and we talk about different things. So I think treating them like persons, and being curious about what do they want to do, and what do they want to do with their lives, and what are they interested in, opens up for a great relationship. And I see it as a privilege to be their father rather than them being my kids. And I think that's a really great way to be, because the kids thrive on that, and they start seeing, because we are their home, we are their base. And if we're solid and we give them that, and we give them the friendship, the communication, I think of myself developing and reading as a prerequisite for them to have that. As long as we treat ourselves like that, I think the kids will be far more kind of capable to deal with the world. And whenever there's a problem, we're the first people to come to, which is very important, because we can support and help them along the way, so they're not feeling alone. So I'm very, that's how my limited approach to parenthood, and I hope that adds some value.
Yeah, it does. I can't help but think, when you're helping founders, there must be a parallel for how you're helping your kids learn about the world and assisting a founder to recognize what is the driving force behind their business or the idea that is yet to become a business. What are maybe some parallels that you've discovered?
Yeah. I think there's a particular balance. My mentorship style is a little bit different than others. There's a balance between I know best and I don't know. And you need to balance those. You can't be the mentor that knows everything and you have just to tell the founder what to do. And you can't be the mentor that is like more like a coach. It's like, what do you want? Like, there are certain things that you have to guide people and tell them, like, no, don't go here. This is a boundary, or be careful, or this is the way you can do something, to give them some base. And you have to be open and give them the space for them to experiment. It's a tough balance to do, and you have to know, and every founder is different. That's the other thing that I learned. I've mentored hundreds of founders. Launch Academy helped 6,000 founders. Collectively, they raised over $2.5 billion. Some of the founders I met when they were like 20, and in 4 years, they sold the company for $370 million, for example. Okay. Like, you can never know where things go. And I felt like privileged to do that. So how do you mentor founders that are working on so many different startups, so many different, you know, fields, and they come from so many different backgrounds and they have different approaches? I think number one, you have to know there are certain, let's say, foundational elements that you have to be very, very skilled at, so that you are able to kind of communicate it to them in different ways, because they're different people. You cannot just repeat the same thing. So that's, I think, the foundational program that we built at Launch Academy. And from there, you need to be open to that, the idea that even though I built like 22 companies and I've mentored all these founders, the founder also may be bringing something completely new or a different perspective. And you have to show them that respect. You have to treat them like a peer, not like, I know you don't. It's like, what are your thoughts on this? How do you see this? So you need to leave space for them to actualize themselves and to make mistakes. And that is very difficult, because you sometimes can see what's right and you want to push them towards it, but you have to let them kind of make their own choices as well. So this is kind of how I managed my mentorship, and I enjoy it. The other thing is that you really have to love the person and love something for the person. What I mean by that, I mean, imagine somebody walking into Launch Academy and the first time I meet them, how can you love a person you don't know? But I think you have to love their humanity and you have to be interested in them succeeding, regardless of what their background. And you have to remember that I'm an entrepreneur as well. I'm always jealous of other entrepreneurs who have brilliant ideas and achieving different things. So that self-management is so important that when a founder comes in, you have to be very committed to them and this and their success. Mm-hmm. And after they're gone, you have to kind of separate yourself because you can't be overbearing. You can't just control. So it's a very tough thing. And I enjoy it thoroughly because it helps me discover my own biases. It's helped me face myself when I'm working with them and demand more of myself. And especially when there's a founder that asks difficult questions, like, oh, I don't know how that, let me come back to you. And these are, I think to be a great mentor, you have to be always learning. You have to be committed to the success of the person, regardless of whether you agree with them or not. And you have to allow for people the space to make mistakes and to grow on their own. Mm-hmm.
Let's go back just a little bit to your education and your continued improvement on yourself. What made you decide to go back to school for blockchain? What made you decide to dive into that?
I'm a geek, so I love technology. I've always loved to learn. And in fact, actually, when I was in university and studying engineering, I remember fourth year, we were the 90s, so there was no internet. There was only one main library, the Assad Library, which was like the central library. There wasn't like libraries everywhere, and books were scarce. So I remember discovering the book, a book that explained the stuff that I was learning, but far better. And I remember diving into that book and loving it so much that I read there, and I ended up failing that year because I read more. I was like, this doesn't make any sense. When I learn more, I should be able to do better. But that's the difference between school and between, like, you know, the difference of you seeking some schools, obviously, and you seeking knowledge and seeking to learn. So I'm always fascinated with learning. Books have always been my friends. I've read like hundreds of books on any topic that I want. I'll pick up a book and dive deep into it. So one day I was in Launch Academy, and blockchain was a thing and Bitcoin was a thing, but every talk about it was more about the value of the coin and, you know, up, down, all of that. And I had no interest in this, in the sense that, of course, I love money, I want more money, but these things I couldn't understand or couldn't relate to. So I attended a workshop. One of the people in Launch Academy was doing a workshop on blockchain. I attended it and I was fascinated. I was like, this is interesting. And then I started reading more. And the more I read about blockchain, the less I understood. I was like, how is this possible? So I got more intrigued. So I spent like 6 months reading. I was like, okay, I need to take it up a notch. So I took a course, strategy, blockchain strategy at Oxford. Then I joined the only master's program that I could find, which is at the University of Cyprus, Nicosia, in Cyprus, which was the first university to launch a program of digital currency. So I joined it, finished my master's. I think I have one course remaining because I was busy. So I just loved the learning because the technology was a fascinating group of older technologies coming together in a very elegant way. So how the technology was built, what is connected to, because it was the only technology that impacts finance, impact other ground technologies. So I got really fascinated. So even though it was like the trend for blockchain, I didn't care about that. I just cared about like, oh, this is something that I can learn. And I started Nexicentrum first as an education company that helps with educating people on emerging technologies, blockchain and AI and stuff. And that's where we are right now. We run these courses and accelerator kind of like programs that helps businesses become skilled at technology in a way that adds value to their business. Mm-hmm. So it was just my passion for learning. And that's why I jumped in. And I still find it fascinating. And I still love technology in every other way.
Yeah. It's going to be fascinating to see the different types of businesses that come out. I mean, they're probably in incubation right now. Slowly, you know, we're seeing some of their names grow. But blockchain technology, if it's going to do what it has, you know, told us it's going to do and really revolutionize our world, it's going to be something that along the way, these businesses are having products. All of a sudden, everyone's going to be on a blockchain, whether they're aware of it or not. And I think your company then educating people about new evolving technologies is going to be extremely important as we keep moving forward. I have just a couple more questions. And I don't know if you want to dive into it too far, but you went to Landmark at one point. And Landmark, I'll describe it as a conference to help one understand more about themselves and how to engage with the world. And normally the people that go to Landmark are those that are seeking support, external support, or they don't know how to resolve problems on their own. What was maybe the issue or the friction point in your life that you were trying to overcome and you couldn't figure out how to do it? And that's why you went to Landmark. If there was one, maybe there was multiple, I don't know.
It's funny. I got to learn about Landmark first because my wife attended Landmark when she was in the US. That was like 20, 25 years ago. And that's how I got the name Landmark. It didn't exist in the Middle East at the time. And then one of the coaches that trained us while working at a company called BNI in 2010, he was part of, like, he taught at Landmark. So he used a lot of that. So I became fascinated mainly because how language is being used in Landmark. So Landmark, if you want to learn about it without attending Landmark, read the book called The Three Laws of Performance. It's a brilliant book, and it talks about the three laws that govern kind of business and how Landmark, actually the three essential things of all the courses in Landmark. And one of the key things is that it's how language shape our world and shape our perception of the world. And one of the things that they talk about is that there is what happens and there is our articulation of what happens. So I was fascinated a lot with Landmark. So when I came to Vancouver, I had forgotten about this. So a friend of mine actually invited me and said, okay, come to this. And I went to one of their sessions where you get to invite people. I was fascinated. I was fascinated with the stories that people are sharing, the transformations that they were experiencing and how they were talking, how the leaders were talking. I'm someone who's fascinated with public speaking and also fascinated with learning. And a lot of the things resonated with what I know, but they had a different perspective. It's like, I'm interested in that. Maybe I should. And my solution is like, let's dive into it. So I'm not afraid of diving. That's one of the things I think I like about myself a lot, which is I'm not fearful of, you know, jumping in, because I trust myself that if I can't handle it, I'll pull myself back and I will make a choice, a different choice. And if I can, and I also trust myself to continue and to press on when I need to. So I jumped in and I attended the Landmark Forum. Brilliant, brilliant, I would say. Landmark has many people, different views from it, but from an education standpoint and what it gives you, it's a very, very powerful experience. And what it does, it really brings you face to face with your own perceptions of life. To put it simply, a lot of the things in life we make up, a lot of how we think about the past, all of that, you know, the past that we're carrying with us or the future that we're dreaming about is all made up, and it's all made up in how we speak about it. So that's kind of the foundational element. And I'm simplifying it way than it is. The experience itself is extremely powerful. I highly recommend you at least explore it. Mm-hmm. And then I loved it so much that I went to all the courses of life. That's how I am. Like when I get into something, it's like, okay, how do I complete it? How do I check it? So I went to all of them except the last two because I couldn't travel to the US at the time. I had my CRM passport. So, and it was quite a transformational experience. I'll give you an example. In one of the companies I worked with, the team, I worked very closely with the CEO. And the team resented that. I was new to the company. I worked very closely with the CEO, and the team resented that, and they kind of rebelled against me. So the CEO sat down with me and said, listen, Hussein, unfortunately, everybody hates you in the company. Oh. And I'm going to have to let you go if that doesn't change. You have 1 week. I mean, I've already kind of decided. That's what he said to me. And I was coming from a place that I was trying to help the company, but what I ended up doing is, because I worked directly with the CEO, everybody was isolated from decision. I didn't see that. So, and the CEO started changing things, And these are the guys that are like, who's this guy who just came, you know, out of nowhere, changed things, and it's impacting all of our roles, and the CEO is not listening to us. They hated that. Mm-hmm. So they rebelled. So what I did, one of the things that the landmark says is like, you know, you come into people and you acknowledge one of the things. So I went and I invited everyone and I sat down with them. I said, hey guys, now here's my intention. Here's what I intended to do. I was intending, you know, to help the company, to help us all, whatever. And in doing so, I may have kind of shown up as a jerk, as someone who didn't care about your roles, who didn't involve you. And I understand that. And I'm sorry, truly, for that. Here's what I want. Here's the future I want. I want us to work as a team. I want us to work together. I want us to build a company that is unstoppable. I want us to, you know, enjoy this work. And I'm willing to do what it takes to do that, if you're open to it. So I acknowledge what's happened, and I took responsibility for it. I apologized, and I created a different possibility. Mm-hmm. That's how Larmark said it. It's like you create a possibility that people, and you give people the chance to step into the possibility. And I said, now you can say whatever you want to say, and please be honest and say whatever you feel. And some people said, yeah, you were actually, I really hated how you do that, or you were a jerk or something. But everyone, after all they said, we really acknowledge that you actually, like, you know, stepped up and said that. Mm-hmm. And so we're willing to work with you. And one by one, they said, we're willing to work with you and work as a team. And it did help that I brought cake from the top cake place in the world, you know, sweetened the deal. The CEO sits with me the day after and said, I don't know what the fuck you did, but in my life, I've never, he ran like big companies, hundreds of employees. I've never seen a transformation like this. What did you do? Like, how did you move people who hate you one day? And the next day, like, they like you and they want to work with you. And I told them, of course, and this is the power of this. And it's not what that landmark gave me the solution. It's landmark that gives you the ability to understand that it's not that they hated me. They hated the actions that, or they were upset by the actions who appeared to them in a certain light. So they have this thing called occur to you. So it's not, it is, it occurs to you like that. So the separation between the reality and your perception of reality. And that kind of gave me so much power. It's like, oh, okay, so what happened right now is not what is. Like, not this person hates me. This person occurs to me that he hates me. Mm-hmm. So then I can change the occurrence with my language and my actions. So then you give you power, and that power is immense. And that kind of planted the seed of that idea of choice, that you have always choice of how to shift how things occur to people. And it's not manipulation, because I have to be genuine. I have to be acknowledge what I did. And I can't say, hey guys, you know, this thing, and I don't believe in it. People will see right through it. Right, that's the other thing. People are great at bullshit barometer. They know things are off, even if they can't say it. So that is my experience.
That's awesome. Thank you for sharing
that. How did you pick up on the landmark thing? I was like, I don't remember what I said. Oh my God, your research is incredible. This is like an interview that I have to remember, like, who does that. I think like either 60 Minutes or Oprah does that. Like, they pick up on things in my life. Like, oh, this guy knows me more than I do. You're awesome. You're awesome, Kyle. Yeah. Please keep going.
Yes. So the title of your book, The Dark Art of Life Mastery, I can't help but wonder, the dark art, where is this darkness coming from? And what does it mean to you? Why is it that you want the reader to understand this dark art?
Yeah. Art, because it's not a science. It's not like 1 + 1 = 2. Life is very kind of changing for everyone. A lot of things don't make sense in life, don't adhere to the rules or the norms, or, you know, aside from the physical, let's say, reality, life doesn't reward us or treat us in any way, let's say, logical sometimes. So I wanted to add the word art there, and because it's how you perceive it and how you see it, kind of like they say, art or beauty is in the eyes of the beholder. So that's why the art there. And the darkness comes from the idea that you need to there is not a path. This is my cat. This is my mischievous mittens.
Oh, adorable.
He loves to is my daughter's cat, but he loves to, I don't know why he loves me. He loves to sit in my lap all the time. So there, the darkness is where, you know, you don't see, most of the time you don't see. So there are two ways or two things for it. Most of the time you don't see the path and you have to feel your way through it. Sometimes you have to walk. It's like fog, you know, you have to walk a few steps in order to see a few steps forward. So that's partly where the dark is. And the other thing is because it's kind of, an odd to Harry Potter, where you're putting the potions together and it blows up in your face. You know, it's kind of like this dark arts where you're kind of figuring out things and you're scheming around life. So it's a bit of play on it rather than. And I wanted it to be not like any self-help book where, you know, like this is the formula for a great life, or this is, you know, the 1, 2, 3 steps or the framework for a mastery. I wanted it to add that element where, you know, this is something that even the best people in the world have not figured out yet. So this is an angle of it, you know, engage, play around. Don't be afraid, because we're all kind of feeling our way through the dark and nobody quite have figured out life yet. And nobody will. It's just for you to figure out and, you know, make it what you wish. Mm-hmm. So that's where it comes from.
Last question for you is, actually, I'd love you to ask a question of the audience, of the world, to help them think about how they can level up in their life. What would be a question you would ask for that?
My favorite question is, what really matters to you right now, at this moment? There's something that is the, what matters most to you? And to expand a little bit on the question is that the idea of what matters to you, it's not, you know, people mostly list a lot of things. There is a follow-up for that, which says, the one thing that if you don't have right now, nothing else matters. I used to have this vision board where I had everything on it. I had like the Mercedes SLS, the red one, climbing Mount Everest, being on the stage of TED, all the cliches. And I did, you know, like I had it in front of me and I would look at it and I would show it to people proudly. And then I asked myself that question. It's like, what really matters to me right now? What is the one thing that if I don't have right now, nothing else matters? Not someday, not after 2 minutes, I want it right now. And it's like happy, healthy family. That was so resounding, so, you know, so loud in my head that I couldn't avoid it. And that kind of changed how I see everything. I didn't let go of my vision, my dream. I changed them a little bit. But this became that at any given moment, it became kind of the anchor, the thing that helped. Do I have this? Okay, everything else can go to hell. Because I don't have control. We all don't have control over anything in life. So at least the one I'm putting my attention on the thing that matters most to me, that brings me the most joy, and it will be different for everyone. So ask yourself, what is the one thing that matters most to you right now, right here? And without it, nothing else matters. And I think if we continue to engage with that question, life will look a little bit different.
Yeah.
Hussein, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it. You have a Substack, you have a LinkedIn. Where else besides those two? And I'm going to be putting the link to your book inside of the show notes. Where else can people reach out if they want to contact you?
HusseinHalak.com. You can reach out there. I'm doing an update hopefully in the next few weeks. But hey, that's my website. Or search Hussein Halak online. Avoid all of the negative stuff. They're all bad. No, just search Hussein Halak. And yeah, reach out to me. If you have a question, if you have a comment, I'd love to hear from you.
Thank you. All right. Really appreciate it. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you, Kyle. You've been awesome.
Thank you for listening to How You Level Up. If you're enjoying the show, subscribe and give a 5-star rating. There are new episodes each month asking questions about timeless communication lessons. Language is a medium for sharing, and the knowledge unpacked here can be applied to anyone, anywhere, facing any challenge. If there's a question or topic you'd like me to dive into next, send a note to any of my connected social media accounts. This is all about how you level up.